Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by and welcome to the 2016 full year results presentation media call. At this time, all participants in a listen-only mode. There'll be a presentation followed by a question and answer session, at which time, if you wish to ask a question, you need to press star 1 on your telephone. I must advise you this conference is being recorded today, Wednesday, the 22nd of February, 2017. I'd like to hand the conference over to your first speaker today, Managing Director and CEO, Mr. Peter Coleman. Thank you, sir. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, and good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us. With me on the call this morning is our CFO, Laurie Tremaine, and I do appreciate the media dialing in on this call. I know it's a busy time of the morning in the reporting season, so we've got a few competing needs here today. It's been a busy year for us at Woodside. We've boosted our production, we've grown our portfolio, and we've set ourselves some very exciting and challenging goals for 2017. You'll see our standard disclaimer on slide 2, and just a quick reminder that this presentation does contain some forward-looking statements and that all of our reported numbers are in US dollars unless otherwise stated. With that, we'll kick off on slide 3 with our financial headlines. You'll see our net profit after tax of $868 million delivers a fully franked dividend of 83 cents per share to our shareholders over the entire year. A strong result through really what's been a low point in the commodity cycle for us in 2016. Our net cash flow from operating activities increased to $2.6 billion and free cash to $114 million. We increased both operating cash flow and free cash flow even though realized prices were down almost 20% on the previous year. At the same time, our gearing remained at around 24% and within our target range. And we remain one of the very few of our peer group that was able to maintain its credit rating through the low point of the commodity cycle, something that I know we're proud of and Laurie's very proud of as well. He'll maybe get some questions on that later. We move to slide 4. I think it's fair to say that in 2018 we delivered operational excellence, we successfully managed risks and volatility, and we added near-term value growth to our portfolio. Our overall production climbed to 94.9 million barrels of oil equivalent in 2016, the second highest level on record, and our Pluto facility achieved record LNG production. Our increased focus on cost efficiencies and reliabilities was reflected in a 28% reduction in our unit production cost. And nothing demonstrates this better than our record low Pluto unit production cost of just $3.30 per OEB. We also increased our portfolio gross margins to 45%, something that we're very proud of. In a tough external environment, we completed the majority of our Northwest Shelf price reviews at traditional levels and signed a heads of agreement for long-term supply of LNG to Pertamina. Near-term value growth was also significantly bolstered. Early in 2016, we announced play-extending discoveries in Myanmar and during the year completed significant acquisitions in Senegal and Australia at an average acquisition cost of just $1.10 per BOE. Together, these discoveries and acquisitions have added more than 30 years of resources to our portfolio when we add that, of course, to the acquisitions that we made the prior year. Construction and commissioning at Wheatstone Train 1 is nearing completion, with first production expected mid-year. And this will be followed by Train 2 and domestic gas production in 2018. We also sanctioned the Greater Enfield project, which is pleasing, and that's targeted for first oil in 2019. You can see we continue to improve our safety and environmental performance. These are key look-throughs to any oil and gas company. You can see that's outlined on slide 5. It's also particularly good to see our flared gas emissions down for a third year in a row with a 33% reduction from 2015. Of course, this was a result of our improved onshore facility reliability and sustained improvement of turnaround practices. Peer comparisons are on slide 6, and we highlight that we're delivering well above our competitors on what we think is a couple of the very key business measures over the long term, which is return on average capital employed, and of course the dividend yield that we provide to our shareholders. We've successfully managed risk and volatility through the cycle and are in a strong position as the oil markets rebalance through 2017. Added to this is the LNG market dynamic on slide 8. And you can see emerging markets and opportunities to create new fuel markets coupled with strong longer-term demand forecasts show that the LNG market will continue to grow through the next decade. Turning to LNG contracting on slide 9, I know this is many of you have asked these questions over time. In 2017, 88% of expected LNG production has been sold under oil-linked term contracts. And I do want to note that we're still seeing demand in the market for oil-linked LNG pricing. Operational excellence and managing risk and volatility will remain core to our approach to delivering value for shareholders. And as you can see on slide 10, alongside these fundamentals, we're continuously building near-term value growth and expect about a 15% increase in production from 2017 through 2020. In 2017, you'll hear me talk about our priorities being Wheatstone, Senegal, Myanmar, and Pluto. When fully operational, Wheatstone will add more than 13 million barrels of oil equivalent to our annual production in our portfolio. This year, we're supporting the operator to execute a flawless startup of Train 1, and details about Wheatstone are on slide 21 in the pack. Next, at SNE oil field in Senegal, the two-well appraisal program is underway to improve our understanding of the reservoir and inform development planning ahead of first oil between 2021 and 2023. In Myanmar, we're about to start a significant drilling program that includes a minimum of 2 appraisal and 2 exploration wells with scope for an additional 3 wells this year. In fact, the rig arrives on site in Myanmar this week. This program will improve our understanding of the resource base and, of course, assist in identifying a path to commerciality in Myanmar. Closer to home, on slide 24, we're evaluating opportunities to maximize our investment in Pluto by undertaking further capacity enhancements and mid to large scale expansion. We're also looking at how we create value through accelerating development timeframes and production, capturing unallocated resources from the Carnarvon and Browse basins, and creating new markets. Woodside is in a unique and fortunate position in the Pilbara, having equity in both key onshore infrastructure and offshore resources. In fact, we're the only company that has equity in both of the largest undeveloped offshore resources and then also the 2 onshore plants that have the earliest expansion opportunity. As part of our drive to grow the LNG fuel market, we're finalising plans to support supplying LNG from Pluto to fuel the local mining and marine sectors and should have a truck loading facility completed on that site by the end of this year. To bring these opportunities together, we're planning to create a Burrup hub that maximises value from infrastructure and investment. To recap, on 2016, our production performance, reduction in operating costs, improved margins, and the progress of our key projects delivered value for shareholders despite the challenging external environment. And before I open up for questions, I just want to mention that this will be Laurie Tremaine's last results briefing with Woodside, and I want to recognise that Laurie has played a key leadership role at Woodside as CFO for the past 6 years. Really has been instrumental in navigating the company through a period of significant volatility. He's had an unswerving focus on the balance sheet resilience and leaves us in a strong position in 2017. So we wish Laurie all the best. With that, I'll open up to questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, you need to press star 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, you need to press the pound or hash key. Once again, that is star 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. Your first question comes to the line of Angela McDonald-Smith from The Australian. Please ask your question.
Hi, yes, from the AFR, actually. Look, Peter, just wanted some thoughts on about where you are with the gas for Pluto expansion, and you know what your thinking is as to where that would come from. Are you thinking about Scarborough, or is it like a rethink of Browse or third party gas, or what? Thanks.
Yeah, there are actually 2 parts to that, Angela. The first one is in the near term, what we're looking at what we can do to accelerate the tail of Pluto. That's meaning bring that gas that's very long dated and bring it forward. We've done a lot of work over the last 2 years to give ourselves confidence, or more confidence, in the Pluto resource. As you're aware, last year we drilled a well, the A5 sidetrack. We've run 4D seismic over the field, and we've also, through the expansion or additional developments at Xena and so forth, now have a much better understanding of the field and the reservoir. That's given us confidence, together with an addition of two exploration wells in our program over the next 12 months, to start to seriously consider a small debottlenecking, or what we call a small expansion project, to start to bring forward gas from the back end of Pluto. So that's the first part of it, and you'll hear more about that as we go through the year. And we're targeting to give investors a more complete update at Investor Briefing Day. The second part then is capturing the big gas. We've always called this Big Oro. It's not Big Oro anymore, because Woodside's actually an equity participant in both the two large undeveloped gas resources out there, being Scarborough and, of course, Browse. The Pluto site is advantaged, as you know. It has capacity in the offshore system. It has an additional one conventional train of capacity in that system. And so it's readily expandable at the site. There are environmental approvals and site preparation already in place for three trains at Pluto. So it's readily expandable at the site. We're looking now to be competitive with the other options for those resources, of course, being floating LNG. So, you know, I think the opportunities in front of us, we're in a unique position, because, you know, we would say we're in a basin master position in many respects, because we're actually the major equity owner in the four assets that need to be pulled together, being Pluto, North West Shelf, Browse, and, of course, Scarborough.
Okay. And just in relation to that, yeah, there's been a bit of talk around about, you know, like how strong, I guess, the LNG market was last year, and demand and prices, you know, in December, et cetera. What's your latest thinking about what it's looking like for the demand outlook over the next few years?
Look, the mid to long-term demand outlook really hasn't changed. And we've always said that this period through 2018, maybe into early 2019, would be a period where there'd be more supply coming into the market than known demand was there. The reality is demand is taking up supply. And so new markets are being created as fast as supply is coming into the market. So there's actually not a supply overhang in market. And it's really because of the advent of FSRUs, and the fact that they can come in very quickly is actually taking demand into the market. And you're seeing switching, of course, occur as well. So there's no stockpiling in this business, Angela, which is much different to the crude oil business. And you don't have ships floating out at sea working on large or long arbitrage positions on it. It's pretty much going to market as quickly as it's produced. In the short term, the reason we're looking at a Pluto expansion, which will be a smaller scale, is we think in the short term, at least over the next 2, 3, 4 years, most of the expansions will be small scale, meaning, you know, in the less than 2 million tonne range, probably in the 1 to 2 million tonne range. For a portfolio player like Woodside, the advantage of that sort of expansion size is, of course, we don't need market. We can actually sell it into our portfolio and get it away. So it gets back to this point where we now start to control the timing of development, which has always been a challenge in the LNG business. So we're quite excited by what the market provides at the moment with all these new buyers coming in.
Okay, thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Sonali Paul from Reuters. Please ask your question.
Hi, Peter and Laurie. On just following up, first of all, on this expansion prospects for Pluto, what sort of timing are we looking at? And also, what sort of costs would you be envisioning for mid-scale or large-scale expansion?
Well, the first part, Sonali, will be mid-scale expansion, and then, of course, the large scale will capture, hopefully, over the next couple of years. So you'll hear a lot more about the small-scale expansion as we go through this year, and we hope to finalise the concept select on that by around the third quarter of this year. So we're doing the work now. We've got some ideas that we're pursuing. We're hoping to finalise concept select by the third quarter of this year. The cost for that expansion is very competitive on global numbers, and we expect to be able to expand Pluto at numbers similar to what you're seeing some of the Gulf Coast plants being expanded at. So that then puts us into a very competitive situation globally to get that away. But it's smaller volumes. It's not the big, huge trains that people have been used to. And as I said, it'll be in that 1 to 1.5 million ton sort of expansion size is what we're looking at.
Okay, thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Perry Williams from Bloomberg. Please ask the question.
Oh, hi, Peter, Laurie. Just a couple of quick ones. Just again on Pluto. So just to be clear, is it a debottlenecking? Is it a new train in terms of the mid-scale expansion? I just wasn't quite clear on that.
Yeah, good question for clarification, Perry. In fact, we're looking at actually those two options. So there's a debottlenecking option where we add. You can call it debottlenecking, but we actually need to add some physical plant to it, but it's quite modest. Or there's an option where we simply say, from a reliability point of view and to get just a little bit more, we can go out to what we call a commoditized train, meaning an off-the-shelf package that is readily available in the marketplace today and simply plug it in. So we're looking at both those options. We're not looking at the big stick-built options. We're looking at something that can be brought to market very quickly, something that can we call it an expansion, but you might call it a super debottleneck.
Yeah, okay. Where did the idea for this come from? I mean, is this something you've seen elsewhere in other markets?
No, it's typical for what we should be doing in this business. So once the infrastructure is built, typically what you do is you should be looking at debottlenecking opportunities. And so that's what we went back to. How it was created was going back to the reservoir and really understanding what the deliverability of the reservoir is, getting comfortable with that, and then basically saying, goodness, if I put this now into an overall strategy, which includes the total Carnarvon Basin, I actually am incentivized to bring gas forward into my sales mix, because it then frees up the plant, a beautiful plant, to be able to take on new resources from the mid-20s onwards, so from 2025 onwards. And so we said, look, there's two opportunities here. One is to actually accelerate and bring forward. At the same time, when you do that, you actually free up potential opportunity in that 2025 space. Once you do that, now you're competing for those other gas resources of Browse and Scarborough.
Yeah, great. And sorry, just the final part of that. I mean, I take it you'd only get to the 1 to 1.5 million tonnes a year through the commoditised train, not through the debottlenecking option?
The debottlenecking would be just under 1. The commoditised train is in that 1 to 1.5. So that's where the increment is, and that's the decision we need to make. There's a slight timing difference between the two and being able to bring it to market, but it's relatively short. So the key thing is we'll be doing what we call a high-rate test in the plant sometime in second quarter. That'll be testing all of the elements of the plant system, and that will then inform us as to whether the best path is to debottleneck or whether to put a small expansion train in.
Yeah, okay, great. And just also in terms of looking forward a little bit more, backfill for Northwest Shelf, I realise that's a few years away, but has there been any more thoughts on that and how you'll tackle that in the years to come?
Well, clearly in the frame, and so no, the North West Shelf partners are working to provide the resource owners that I described, both Browse and Scarborough, previously Hess, as was documented, with tolling arrangements and cost structures for getting that product through the plant. So as I said, Woodside's in a unique position, notwithstanding the firewalls we need to put in place, but we can see as a resource owner in all of those projects where the best place to go is, and we think we have an opportunity to do what's been done elsewhere, I must say, and avoid maybe some of the opportunities that have been missed elsewhere as well, and bring all of this together, which is why you'll start to hear us talking about the creation of a hub at the Burrup, which includes bringing those resources in, which includes getting LNG into the domestic market to allow it to fuel ships, to allow it to fuel mining trucks and locomotives and so forth.
And you're referring to Gladstone there? Or?
Well, I think it's been documented and talked about a lot as to where, you know, there's been inefficient use of capital. So I think industry needs to look at it, Woodside reflected on the learnings, but there's also other projects, in the proximity or in the region that are working hard to bring resources together and benefit from the existing infrastructure. And I think that's the future, to be honest. It's about infrastructure sharing, and it's about taking a sensible approach to that sharing and making sure the capital is used as efficiently as it should be.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Kevin Morrison from Argus Media. Please ask your question.
Yes, sir. Good morning. Just a question on the demand outlook for the global LNG markets on slide 8, saying that the additional 16 million tonnes capacity is required to meet annual demand. That demand, is that net new demand, or is that replacing LNG supply has been exhausted?
Kevin, there's a little bit of both in that. So our numbers are more conservative than you'll find others put out there in the market. So we're kind of at the low end of what you'll see some of the published numbers out there. But it includes both a net demand, supply going out of the market, and then also new demand coming into the market. What I would point out, and I say this is, we think we're at the conservative end of this, is, a lot of this is driven by macroeconomic trends and assumptions around macroeconomics and energy use as a function of GDP. Government policy is the big game changer in all of this, and government policy is often driven by the needs of the population. That comes down to things like things that are harder to measure the impact of, things like the demand to reduce greenhouse gases, things like the demand to clean up the air and reduce particulates emissions and so forth. So I would say there's early signals of game changes here, and the first of those, of course, being the International Maritime Organization's ruling in December of last year to change shipping fleet globally from a 3.5% sulfur fuel to a 0.5% sulfur fuel by 2020. That has potential to be a game changer, and you would have seen that we've already entered into a joint industry study agreement with the three big miners in Australia to look at the impacts and the opportunity that provides. To put it into context, in China, the bus fleet, if the Chinese chose to change all of their buses to compressed natural gas overnight, that's 20 million tonnes straight away in the marketplace. So there's a lot of opportunity here for government policy to change this demand quite rapidly. And so we see more upside to this than we do downside at this point.
I mean, just touching on that, the government policy, because you made some comments last year just in regards to, with greenhouse gas emissions and gas replacing coal. But, I mean, it's obviously very contested from the coal industry. Where do you see that moving? I mean, obviously, you know, here domestically, I mean, there's been a big push by the coal industry to, you know, come out with a new sort of marketing brand for coal, and you know, and the government seems to be, you know, playing alongside with that. I mean, it's you know. So it doesn't seem like a lot of movement here. You know, how do you see that sort of more on a global pace?
Yeah. Yeah, look, Kevin, we're not in the business of driving coal out of the mix at all. In fact, we've been very clear on the record. We think to ensure safe, reliable and affordable energy, you need to have all sources coming into the mix. And the world needs to move away from picking carbon winners in this space. There's too much of that going on at the moment. You can see what that leads to when you have an over-reliance on one source of energy at the expense of others. So we firmly believe that all energy sources need to be in the mix. Our pitch on this, though, is let's get it in the right proportions and in the right use. The challenges that we saw over a couple of years ago were that other energy sources were growing disproportionately in that mix. And our view is that gas in particular needs to have a significant part of that mix, and, you know, maybe up to 30% of the energy mix in advanced economies, those that have secure energy systems.
That's for power generation, you mean, not in the totality of the...
Well, no, it'll be in the totality because... Right. Power gen is the obvious one that's easiest to measure and people focus on, but the reality is, you know, gas can do things that other fossil fuels can't, and it's certainly something that's a great replacement for maybe the higher emissions end of the liquid fuel market. And so, you know, we think gas really has a role in there in all its different forms. The key there, and we've seen it across all of our activities around the world, is once we make it available, we make it in quantities that's available, make it reliable, and make it affordable, it really is the fuel of choice, and people will go for gas time and time and time again. So we just see that market expanding, particularly in, as we've already indicated, in the transportation fleet and in the small business usage of gas.
Okay, but just, I mean, just going back to my original question, can you just sort of break down that 16 million in terms of like how much it would be net new and how much would be just replacement of existing?
Not off the top of my head, Kevin, okay. But we'll get the guys will get back to you.
Sure. All right. Thanks.
Marketers will get back to you and we'll tell you exactly how that breakdown is.
Your next question comes from the line of Russell Sank from Upstream. Please ask your question.
Morning, Peter. Just to go back to Pluto, can I just be clear here that we're talking about, or that you are talking about a potential two-phase expansion? So the first phase would be taking your own gas. Second phase, your own gas or potentially other gas.
Beautiful, Russell. You've knocked it out of the park. The first phase is really looking at existing Pluto gas. The gas that currently exists within the Pluto permit areas is the first phase. The second phase then is an opportunity to both grow and expand Pluto. And there's a couple of opportunities there that we're pursuing over the next 2 years. One of those, of course, I've mentioned this morning being Scarborough and Browse, and Pluto will be competing for those resources to come in. We also, Woodside and our partners will be drilling two exploration wells, one called Swell this year, a partner there is Cuffbeck, and then the second one is Ferrand, which Woodside's 100%, and we'll drill that in the middle of next year. Both those wells have been approved internally, and the contracting for the drilling rig is all in place. They're multi-TCF type opportunities that we're pursuing. And so you can see we're now starting to build a number of options for us to bring it in, which gives us the confidence now that we can move forward into serious planning and start some of the pre-engineering work on this.
Okay. Well, that's fantastic. That's exciting. The Sunrise project what can you say about? Can you say anything about that, Peter? In terms of there's been some progress there on the political front. So, what do you see as an ideal outcome of the negotiations on the boundary? And what do you see as an ideal outcome?
Look, the ideal outcome really is both governments being comfortable with whatever is finally agreed, because that's the key for us, as a resource developer, is that you want to make sure that whatever is ultimately agreed, that both governments are very comfortable with that to the extent that they feel like they can move forward together. That then gives us confidence to move forward. What you don't want is a situation where one government feels aggrieved in the process, and I think that's probably what's led us to this point now. So if we can get to a point where both governments feel very comfortable with the outcome, then I think that's tremendous for the project.
And Woodside's still fully committed to Sunrise?
Oh, absolutely. We continue to remind the government that both governments that Sunrise is one of the most competitive resources globally on a cost of development. It's also very liquids rich, so as distinct from some of the other developments in the region that don't benefit from liquid production, Sunrise does. And so in that context, we very much look forward to moving forward on Sunrise if we could.
The PSCs, my understanding, based on your fourth quarter, is that the PSCs are still alive and well. I believe that still goes on for another 10 years.
I'm off the top of my head, I'm not sure on the exact term, but the PSCs are alive and well, and both governments, particularly the Timorese, have gone to lengths to assure us that they are in place. Of course, we're going to have to look at the back end of those PSCs and any discussions around that post-resolution of the maritime boundaries will need to include what we think will need to be a life period on those PSCs that reflects the life of the project.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks.
Your next question comes to the line of Peter Williams from WA Newspaper. Please ask your question.
Hi, Peter. Can I just ask, this plan for creating a Burrup Hub, the expansion there, does that suggest that Woodside is leaning towards the onshore processing option for browse?
No, it's a good question, Peter. I mentioned previously that we need to keep commercial tension on this, and we also need to make sure that we get the very best development. So both Browse and Scarborough at the moment have a floating LNG case as their preferred development. What we're saying is we want to knuckle down, pull all of this together, and make the case that an onshore development should be a very competitive case that the joint venture partners in both those resources seriously consider. So I'd say at the moment we're starting from behind, because FLNG is the preferred case at this point. And I think it's up to the joint venture partners in both those onshore assets, being the North West Shelf and Pluto. As I mentioned, we have the advantage that we are in both, to put our best foot forward and make sure that we provide the most compelling case we can to get those resources coming that way. So that's what we're about. If we don't, then the option will be floating, and so we need to work hard on it. It's not a given at this point, but equally, our view is there's a huge opportunity to be able to more efficiently utilize, and that opportunity is presenting itself with the ullage at the North West Shelf that comes in post in the early 2020s, or the spare capacity post 2020, and then of course, as I mentioned previously, we're looking for options to bring forward, free capacity in Pluto as well to be able to compete.
So be your preference, or be Woodside's preference, to have onshore processing for Browse if it was competitive?
Well, our preference is to get the best commercial outcome, and that's what we're really about. So it's the best commercial outcome. And then, of course, you'll look at technology risk and execution risk and so forth. But yeah, I think the key is let's get the best commercial outcome first before we say what our preference is. Because otherwise you start moving down a path that's not commercially driven. You know, it needs to be commercially driven first and foremost, and the best commercial outcome.
Okay, can I just ask one more question of Laurie, if you wouldn't mind answering why you decided to make the move to Origin Energy and when you expect to take up that appointment?
Oh, hi, Peter. I've had a great time at Woodside and have been given an enormous amount of opportunity over the years, but it's been 10 years now, and so, put simply, I think it's time for me to take on another challenge, and that's the start and end of it. Peter and I are still talking about when exactly I'll move across, so you'll have to wait, just as I do.
All right. Was there a personal preference there to be based in Sydney? Did that have anything to do with it?
No, it really is about the opportunity, Peter. I know it's everyone's looking for some other reason, but the fact is 10 years at Woodside, I think I leave the company now in a very strong position, both within the groups that I have been leading for at least the last six, but also from the opportunity set Woodside's got. So that's what I leave behind. What I move to is a slightly different business, particularly around the gas and power markets part of Origin. So that's exciting. And obviously there are some challenges there, which I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, all right. Thanks a lot, Laurie. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, Peter, if I can jump in. Laurie leaves us in really good shape. So, you know, as you've seen from the results this year and the strength of our balance sheet, the financing that we've put in place over the next few years, you know, the timing is obviously good for Laurie, but it's also, you know, for Woodside, it's a good time to make a transition if a transition ever has to take place. So it's good for us. We've got strong internal candidates for the role. We'll obviously, because of the importance of it, we'll go externally as well and test the market. We've always got to test the quality of our people against the external market, and we're confident that they'll compete strongly for the role. We're in no hurry to move Laurie out the door. So, as far as I know, he doesn't have any plans to go sit on the beach for a while. So, no, we're going to work him up to, as long as makes sense for both of us, and we can make an orderly transition.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And your last question comes from the line of Andrew White from the Australian newspaper. Please ask your question.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for your time. I just wanted to ask, with AGL looking at building an LNG import terminal to service the East Coast gas market, just wondering, what do you make of the opportunities on the eastern seaboard and what sort of plans do you have, if any, to address them, given...
It's a good question. It's a difficult market for us to understand at the moment, to be honest with you. We've done some work on it to try and understand it, but, you know, it's a market that I'd say is characterized, it's dominant, you know, very much dominated by a small number of export producers. It's got a relatively small domestic market demand. It's undergone significant changes, you know, in the last 3 years. So it's probably not surprising that some of the issues that you see now have arisen simply because of the fundamental change in the market dynamics and where the gas is flowing, and then also some of the market power that some of those users have, both on a production side and then also on being able to access market and buy third-party gas. So there's a lot of change going on. I'd say there's some really big players in the room now moving large quantities of gas fairly aggressively that we didn't see before. You know, for a company like Woodside, we'd like to see that settle down before we make any decisions about whether we participate in that market. Of course, if somebody builds a import facility that has obviously been discussed in the press, Woodside will be there buying to buy that facility with market-based pricing. So, we've got the gas if people put the facilities in place.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
There are no further questions at this time. I would like to hand the call back to your speaker. Please continue.
All right. Look, again, thanks everybody this morning for taking the time out with us. We've got investors later in the morning, but we always think it's important to have a one-on-one discussion, so to speak, with the media beforehand. Again, I hope you get something valuable out of this. As you've seen, Woodside really turned around the business in the last 12 to 24 months in a period that's been very, very difficult for the industry. I think the results speak for themselves. But it's not just about the past, it's also about the future. We've been very busy in building our future. We're a fundamentally different company to the one we were 5 years ago, and the opportunity set in front of us now is very much world class. So we look forward to giving you progress as we go through the year on those four major priorities that we have, being, of course, Wheatstone, Senegal, Myanmar, and Pluto. So, again, thanks very much for your interest this morning, and I'm sure we'll catch up over the next few days and weeks.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude our conference call for today. Thank you for participating. You may all disconnect.